think we are on page 749. Debashista, did we finish that paragraph which says, which ends with these would be the two possible alternatives?
Trying to locate it here. These could be the two possible alternatives.
Oh, that's the ending though, it's not the beginning.
Yeah, that's the end of the paragraph.
Probably it's easier if you tell them the
Oh,
ending.
okay, I found that, yeah. But what if we if it were found, is that paragraph, right?
Yeah.
So actually, we had moved on and considered the next paragraph, which was very dense, I think. But maybe we can start from there. I don't know what others feel. I do recollect that we had done the next paragraph at least. But we can revisit that because it was so packed and dense. What I'd suggest is that we read through this paragraph you just mentioned, but what if it were found with the increase of our knowledge? Because what Sri Aurobindo is doing at this point is he is fielding a certain division between modern and ancient theories. And firstly, the whole idea that rebirth cannot exist because existence, human consciousness is ultimately grounded in matter, which is the modern materialist viewpoint, is being contrasted with ancient theories where there is the notion of an afterlife. And in this notion of an afterlife, he's considering whether this afterlife is an individualized afterlife that has no beginning and no end, or whether it is an afterlife that sooner or later gets swallowed up or dissolved into some universal principle, be it a kind of universal life or a universal mind or universal spirit. So this is the division that he has introduced. And he's introducing this because he recognizes the fact that the prevalent understanding in modern times is based on the kind of assumption that there is no afterlife, that it's just a kind of a, a superstition from old times. And such a sort of attitude is only based on the supposed sort of superiority of the material viewpoint, that it must be correct because we can't see it, so what evidence can there be for it? It must be just imagination of old people who needed to create theories to satisfy their fears. So that's why he fields that particular idea and the paragraph you just mentioned, but what if it were found with the increase of our knowledge, is where he starts to address this and put it aside before going deeper into the question of the individual sort of basis of the afterlife. So why don't we start? Somebody can start reading from, but what if it were found, and read on to the next paragraph.
Shyam, do you want to read?
But what if it were found with the increase of our knowledge, as certain researches and discoveries seem to presage, that the dependence of the mental being or the psychic entity in us on the body is not so complete as we at first naturally conclude it to be from the study of the data of physical existence and the physical universe alone. What if it were found that the human personality survives the death of the body and moves between other planes and this material universe? The prevalent modern idea of a temporary conscious existence would then have to broaden itself and admit a life that has a wider range than the physical universe, and admit to a personal individuality not dependent on the material body. It might have practically to readopt the ancient idea of a subtle form or body inhabited by a psychic entity, a psychic or soul entity carrying with it the mental consciousness. Or, if there be no such original soul, then the evolved and persistent mental individual would continue after death in the subtle persistent form, which must have been either created for it before this birth, or by the birth itself, or during the life. For either a psychic entity pre-exists in other worlds in a subtle form and comes from there with it to its brief earthly sojourn, or the soul develops here in the material world itself, and with it a psychic body is developed in the course of nature and persists after death in other worlds or by reincarnation here. These would be the two possible alternatives. Do you want me to read on to the next hour?
Maybe we can pause a little bit at this point and just absorb that for a moment before reading on, and just kind of get a sense of what he's saying. So here, as you see, he is making the argument which is being made these days, in fact. I mean, it's actually an old philosophical argument that was made as a kind of a protestation against exclusive materialistic basis in the 18th century itself, but was drowned, so to say, by modern understandings, but it is being made again by a number of thinkers, which is that, I mean, we cannot assume the dependence of the mind on matter, and that's why he's saying over here, I mean, there's too much to the operations of the mind, and also to a certain kind of intermittence or even latency of mind in nature, in material phenomena, for us to assume that mind is necessarily tied to matter or dependent on matter. So he's saying, but what if it were found with the increase of our knowledge? And then he's talking about certain researches and discoveries. We touched on this last time, that the dependences of the material being or the psychic entity on the body is not so complete as at first naturally concluded to be from the study of the data of physical existence, etc. And so then the question arises, what is the composition of this conscious being inside us? What is this personality? And then it's not so difficult to assume that it may persist after the disappearance of the body. But then, even if it does, or if we assume that it does, the question is, where did it come from? And where will it go? And when did it arise? And will it disappear at some point? So those are the real questions, and so he's fielding those ideas over here. Says it may have practically to readopt the ancient idea of a subtle form of body inhabited by a psychic entity. But then that puts us into the whole very large field of the afterlife and of what is it that survives the demise of the body. A psychic or soul entity carrying with it the mental consciousness. Or if there were no such original soul, then the evolved and persistent mental individual would continue after death in this subtle persistent form, which must have been either created for it before this birth, or by the birth itself, or during the life. So this conscious being that we have inside us, which is not necessarily, let's assume for the time being, as he says, tied to the body. Where did it come from? What is its composition? Is it a mental formation? And if it is a mental formation, did it have its origin in the mind world before it entered us? Was it sort of generated in the life of the body? Or was it in some way sort of formed during processes of growth in the body? These are the three things he's saying. And he's also fielding another idea that the mental being is being carried by another kind of consciousness, the psychic consciousness, or the psychic being, the soul being, the soul entity. So there he says, for either a psychic entity pre-exists in other worlds in a subtle form and comes from there with it to its brief earthly sojourn, or the soul develops here in the material world itself, and with it a psychic body is developed in the course of nature and persists after death in other worlds or by reincarnation here. These would be the two possible alternatives. So this psychic being, does it have as its origin and its natural world some world outside this world, some reality outside this world? Or is the natural home of this psychic being here the material world itself? And does it develop here? Does it grow here? And in its persistence, does it reincarnate here? In other words, if there is whatever this thing that is persisting after the body, is it something that has some kind of persistent mission to complete here on Earth? Is that its natural space? Or is the assumption of a body by this entity kind of a brief and accidental episode, that its natural home is somewhere else, it comes, takes a life and disappears? Or is it that it comes here and gets trapped here for a temporary number of lives and then goes back to its original other world, so to say? These are the two alternatives that he's positing here. And as we know, in Sri Aurobindo's view, the soul is eternal, but its real home is here. Its existence, and by earth he means over here the evolving center of a kind of a divine universe. And, you know, of course, I mean, to be too literal about material earth over here may be a little questionable. But nevertheless, the idea is that this existence where evolution is occurring is the proper location of the soul's existence, evolution, and rebirth. So anyway, he's introducing this. And the reason he's introducing this is that there is a tight necessity connecting the evolution of the soul with the existence of the soul. If there is an afterlife, that afterlife is very sort of coherently connected with the logic of the evolving soul and the manifestation of the divine in matter. So this becomes the basic idea. So when he's talking about other worlds and the existence of some kind of a persistent body that assumes a material body and returns to those other worlds, there would be no coherence or necessity binding it. It would enter and leave as if it were an accident or because of some kind of a law or necessity that is extraterrestrial. You know, we talked about the notion of the yaksha in Meghdootam. Ideas like that exist in classical literature, where non-evolutionary beings, due to some problem or something wrong that they did, are forced to have a brief sojourn on Earth. Now, these kind of things may happen otherwise as well, but you know they are rare. The real, consistent, repetition is that of necessity that ties human beings to the earth. One second.
Kika. Wait. It's going to be fun now. Is she there?
Yeah, connecting.
Usually we could never do more than 10. So it's not going to connect, I think. We'll put Mira on YM.
It's connected.
Good. She can't hear us. Somebody went away. Vincent dropped.
Shall we continue or are we waiting for something more?
No, I think let's continue unless there's any questions or comments.
The paragraph, yeah. So when we start this paragraph, right, we have already branched off to that there is already the case where the personality may exist the personality may exist beyond the death of the body. Correct?
Yeah.
But so given that, what is the second of the two alternatives? The first alternative is very clear, that something from outside came, inhabited this body, and is going away to wherever it came from.
Right.
In the second, if it is just evolving, if it's something that was formed with the beginning of life and is growing in life, then how does that tie in with the existence of something, the persistence of something after the death? If such a thing persists, is it that it didn't come from earlier, but just that it was born here, but would persist afterward?
Yeah, this is a good question, which is actually latent in this paragraph, which he's going to develop in the next few paragraphs.
Okay.
So he's putting aside, he's kind of opening up the possibilities, and he's showing us that, you know, the first of the two options, as you said, has to do with something which is accidental to earthly existence. And the second, something which is tied into earthly existence. And the second has within it a lot of possibilities. One is that it developed out of some earthly principle itself, you know, like a universal mind or universal life present on earth, or, you know, that it came from elsewhere, but it developed here. In other words, even if it comes from elsewhere, it doesn't have any scope of evolution elsewhere. It develops here. And its persistence is either happening entirely here, that is, in a succession of lives on earth, or in a succession of lives on earth with intermediate lives outside the earth, but nevertheless tied to lives on earth. This is the wide possibility sort of locus that he's introducing in the second option.
Okay, so the second is actually opening up that he would kind of build up on the many possibilities that it kind of introduces to as we go along. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as you see in the next paragraph, he shows that in the very next paragraph how complex this question is, because a number of options are contained in this question. And a number of world philosophies and attitudes towards rebirth have developed due to the complexity of this question.
Okay. So the other thing, which is probably a little irrelevant, but talking of the yakshas, sorry?
One second, I think Vince is calling me. Just give me a moment.
I'm trying to log in because...
I don't know. These are all.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it was just
probably better left on the grapevine.
Okay.
Grapes not plucked. But you see, the thing is that this issue about you know, coming temporarily and things like that, he's introducing them because. I mean, as soon as you admit that there can be a personality that persists after the death of the body, you really open up a huge can of worms because so many kinds of possibilities are there. And what he's going to show is, I mean, that through the millennia, people have thought about this and have had perhaps experiences of partial kinds that have made them come up with theories. And this is one of the whole problems about theories of the invisible and the occult, that they are presenting certain kinds of realities or possible realities, which in some way we don't have any way of knowing whether they're true until we experience them. And then if they were not true, it perhaps is too late by the time we experience the fact that they are not true to do anything about it. You know, so here, as he's going to, you know, the material Aurobindo uses here is very interesting in that he is going to give us all these various theories as possibilities, but also going to reason himself, reason the kind of, connect or combine the intuitive roots of experience with reason to come up with a darshan that is consistent and that, in a sense, rejects the pictures that seem arbitrary.
It seems, in mainstream thought or whatever, it seems that generally, like, the idea is that if you give, without the experience, if you simply add that extra degree of freedom that you allow for the afterlife, then that's like, kind of the notion is that you can explain anything and everything by adding that extra degree of freedom. So without that experience, it's kind of very speculative and it's kind of a cop-out, you could say.
You see, that's why he begins this entire train of thought by introducing a difference or division between modern schools and ancient schools. Ancient schools did not believe in the dependence of consciousness on the body, and since they didn't, then the afterlife is quite natural to sort of assume that it's possibility. But once that is done, then the question remains as to what about it, you know, or what are the, you know, sort of grounds of that possibility. So now we have to look at it. And we also see that these ancient theories, that's why he's saying, he has already pointed out that to Advaita and Buddhism, for example, there is no necessity to assume a rebirth. It's not tied to a necessity, in other words. So in that case, why did they assume it? Well, they assumed it because it was already part of received ancient knowledge. And that's the whole thing that he's pointing out here, is that there are certain aspects to ancient knowledge which are truths that have become fragmented and muddied, and all kinds of half-logical sort of, you know, theories have arisen around them. The history of Indian spirituality itself is not that sort of coherent, and that's part of what he's going to point out later. Today, there's a huge sort of debate or battle that's going on between Western Indologists and Indian, you know, people who kind of have some sense of pride about being Indian, in that the Western Indologists are pointing out that a lot of things have happened historically. They were not there in the beginning, and they popped up at certain points in the historical record. You know, the other version from, you know, a lot of Indian thinkers is saying that, no, this is not correct, and we always had all the knowledge. It's basically something to that effect. I'd say that Sri Aurobindo steers kind of a path which is in some way closer to the Western Indologist, that he does believe that there has been spiritual thought, a history of spiritual experience, and that over time a number of sort of, you know, muddy you know, theories have been you know, shown to be inadequate.
Yeah, so just one more point. So you're saying that even in the Buddhist and Vedantic inquiries, some element of, you know, historical influence came rather than just the rigid inquiry and the intuition itself. So to some degree, even though they may not have needed it, they still kind of incorporated it because of historical reasons.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the whole thing about discourse. Nothing happens in a vacuum. We always start with certain assumptions. Today, somebody is born into a kind of a world which is already seeded with assumptions which are materialistic. In Buddha's time, they were already born into a world which was seeded with assumptions about rebirth.
So it's very difficult to get out of that, you know, that base set, like, to get it into the complete, you know, purity of thought. Correct?
Yeah, of course it is. But you see, one of the good things that has happened in our present times is because of all this tremendous amount of doubting and questioning that has happened, we are in a position to some extent to be purified. I mean, it's been, even materialism has been a purifying experience. From that point of view, we have been driven to question the roots of our own beliefs so that we can be open to something which is much more integral. Today, you know, the notion of received beliefs is much more conscious in us today.
Shall we read the next? Louise, do you want to start?
Okay, it's a long one. Okay. An evolving universal life may have developed on Earth the growing personality that has now become ourselves before it entered a human body at all. The soul in us may have evolved in lower life shapes before man was created. In that case, our personality has previously inhabited animal forms, and the subtle body would be a plastic formation carried from birth to birth, but adapting itself to whatever physical shape the soul inhabits. Or the evolving life may be able to build a personality capable of survival, but only in the human form when that is created. This would happen by the force of a sudden growth of mental consciousness, and at the same time, a sheath of subtle mind substance might develop and help to individualize this mental consciousness, and would then function as an inner body, just as the gross physical form, by its organization, at once individualizes and houses the animal mind and life. On the former supposition, we must admit that the animal too survives the dissolution of the physical body and has some kind of soul formation, after which death occupies other animal forms on earth, and finally a human body. For there is little likelihood that the animal soul passes beyond earth and enters other planes of life than the physical, and constantly returns here until it is ready for the human incarnation. The animal's conscious individuation does not seem sufficient to bear such a transfer or to adapt itself to other worldly existence. On the second supposition, the power thus to survive the death of the physical body in other states of existence would only arrive with the human stage of the evolution. If indeed the soul is not such a constructed personality evolved by life, but a persistent, unevolving reality with a terrestrial life and body as its necessary field, the theory of rebirth in the sense of the Pythagorean transmigration would have to be admitted. But if it is a persistent, evolving entity capable of passing beyond the terrestrial stage, then the Indian idea of a passage to other worlds and a return to terrestrial birth would become possible and highly probable. But it would not be inevitable, for it might be supposed that the human personality, once capable of attaining to other planes, need not return from them. It would naturally, in the absence of some greater compelling reason, pursue its existence upon the higher plane to which it had arisen. It would have finished with the terrestrial life evolution. Only if faced with actual evidence of a return to Earth would a larger supposition be compulsory and the admission of a repeated rebirth in human forms become inevitable.
So, yeah, hello. Yeah, we had actually done this long and complex paragraph last time, actually. I'm not sure when, but I remember this paragraph rather vividly because of its complexity, in fact. And what is happening over here is that he is taking up that instance of a soul personality or a conscious personality. He's using the word soul over here in an undefined manner. He hasn't yet defined it in terms that we are familiar with, that is, as the psychic being, etc. Whatever it is, this conscious personality, as he's calling it, if it is tied to the earth and to rebirths here, then he is now considering this possibility that it has arisen due to the processes of life. That is, life as a universal power has created these kind of sort of formations, these invisible, non-material, qualitative formations, and he's pointing out two possibilities. Either they inhabit different bodies, or they inhabit different bodies, but also assume some kind of a kind of growth of that particular form, of the subtle form. So here they are. In either case, you know, by the time, if life has evolved these personalities, by the time the human conscious personality makes its appearance, it must have assumed lives in other pre-human forms, animal forms, as he says over here. So the two possibilities there, in that case, our personality has previously inhabited animal forms, and the subtle body would be a plastic formation carried from birth to birth, but adapting itself to whatever physical shape the soul inhabits. Now, on the other hand, the evolving life may be able to build a personality capable of survival. In other words, it isn't that this kind of, you know, sort of fluid conscious substance just adapts itself to some kind of a material form without any persistent growth. It may be that it grows and forms a personality. Now, this growth and formation of a personality then, would it be something that is showing its reality in animal lives, or does it show its reality only in human lives? So that's where Sri Aurobindo is mustering one of his great intuitions, you know, a kind of a sense that it is with the appearance of mind consciousness that a kind of identity, individualized identity, appears to the conscious personality. Okay. Prior to that, we can talk about the beginnings of personality, but a kind of persistent identity is difficult to posit prior to the human individual. That's why he's saying over here, if that has been the case, then it must be the mind which is responsible in the human being for imparting another sheath or layer to that conscious personality developed by life. So he's saying, all the evolving life may be able to build a personality capable of survival, but only in the human form when that is created. This would happen by force of a sudden growth of mental consciousness, and at the same time a sheath of subtle mind substance might develop and help to individualize this mental consciousness and would then function as an inner body, just as the gross physical form by its organization at once individualizes and houses the animal mind and life. So this is a distinct inner body, in other words, given its distinct form of individual personality by a mind sheath, which houses within it, you know, the more plastic or fluid kind of consciousness developed by life that can inhabit any form it wishes. On the former supposition, and here he is taking those two suppositions, the animal too survives the dissolution of the physical body and has some kind of soul formation which after death occupies other animal forms on earth, and finally a human body. But then he's saying over here that the animal soul must in that case be passing from life to life on earth itself, because it doesn't seem to have that power of persistent survival in the subtle personality that would allow it to persist in other forms and then return to life forms. Okay, and it's a very interesting kind of observation, because again, it is tied to an intuition which says that what gives distinct form is the body, and therefore animal consciousness develops in a kind of nascent way certain properties which survive only due to the fact that it occupies another animal body right away. If it were allowed to move into worlds where it didn't have the distinctiveness of a body, it couldn't survive. This is the argument he's making here. It's only due to the formation of something more durable at the human stage that it is possible for this soul personality or whatever conscious personality to persist separate from the body for prolonged periods of time and in other conditions than what are material. So he's saying, he goes down over there. On the second supposition, the power thus to survive the death of the physical body in other states of existence would only arrive at the human stage of evolution. Now, then he brings in this possibility that there isn't any growth or development of the soul, but it appears in the human. And if that is the case, then he's saying, again, there is no need or necessity for the survival of this personality in other worlds or in other conditions outside of the material realm. That is what Pythagorean transmigration is all about. If indeed the soul is not such a constructed personality evolved by life, but a persistent, unevolving reality with a terrestrial life and body as its necessary field, this is sort of like, we may translate it and say, there is an Atman, but there is no psychic being. Okay, there is a unevolving entity that is in some way sort of experiencing whatever the field of life and matter are, and mind are giving it. Okay, then in this theory of rebirth, the theory of rebirth in the sense of Pythagorean transmigration would have to be admitted. In other words, it moves from scene to scene of this life. But if it is a persistent evolving entity capable of passing beyond the terrestrial stage, then the Indian idea of a passage to other worlds and a return to terrestrial birth would become possible and highly probable. So here he's contrasting the Greek view with the Indian. And the Indian view is taking from the Vedanta, from the Upanishads, where the notion is that there is a persistence of the soul, not merely a rebirth here, but a persistence that takes one, the personality to other worlds, to this, on this journey, and then brings it back here at the end of that journey. But he says it would not be inevitable. That's the point that he's making here. It's probable, but it would not be inevitable. Again, Sri Aurobindo is trying to develop a tight theory which binds by necessity the life of the evolving soul to its rebirths here on earth. Why is it necessary? Okay. For it might be supposed that the human personality, once capable of attaining to other planes, need not return from them. So this is not the case of the yaksha who just comes for a brief sojourn and goes back, but this is the case of the soul that goes to Vaikuntha at a certain point and chooses not to come back, or goes to the western pure land of Amitabha Buddha and remains there for the rest of its you know, eternity, or that arises after the day of judgment and stays in heaven forever, okay? So, or in hell for that matter. So once it goes to another world, why should it have to come back? It's not inevitable. That's the point he's making about there, these theories don't have any rigorous necessity for the soul's continued sojourn on earth. It would have finished with the terrestrial life evolution. At a certain height, even if we admit an evolution, it would go to another plane of consciousness and remain there. Only if faced with actual evidence of a return to Earth would a larger supposition be compulsory and the admission of a repeated rebirth in human forms become inevitable. So again, in this very complex paragraph, he opens up many possibilities and leaves several of them unresolved, but shows the fact that there are, you know, sort of loopholes in all of them. It doesn't bind tightly to a continued existence on Earth, though this much is, you know, sort of very probable, that the individual survival of a kind of a personality with a distinct formation is tied to the appearance of mind on the earth, that is, in a human being, and that these human lives can persist outside of the earth as well. This much you can say is established in this paragraph, but whether it needs to come back to this earth again and again, or whether it evolves at all or not, or whether it is developed by life and goes back to life, dissolves back to life or not, or has some other origin, are questions that are left unanswered.
So, where did evolving and unevolving come into this thing? It was, I mean, I'm not clear how we got into this evolution versus something else, transmigration or wherever. How did we start off on that? I think it's kind of, I lost the trail there.
Well, he's bringing that in because this whole paragraph is actually about the universal life force creating these personalities that enter into bodies. So, what is the nature of that personality? This is the question he's asking. Firstly, is it a personality that kind of moves like a sort of a fluid in different bottles, you know, from life to life? In which case it's sort of tied to the earth. Okay, so if it's tied to the earth, then life on earth has prepared material forms and it has also prepared vital forms. These are the vital forms, and the vital forms would not have any distinct characteristics but move into bodies indiscriminately. That would be one possibility. And that could admit for or admit existence in animal bodies and in human bodies. Another possibility would be that it would take on a distinctive character in the human being due to the presence of mind, and would survive with that distinctive individuality, some kind of inner individuality, from human life to human life. That is the second possibility. The third possibility is that it, whether it appears as a kind of a existence in the animal or in the human, that it does not evolve that it's again it's like that fluid thing, but it occupies, just as it occupied a number of animal lives tied to the earth, bodies that were offered to it, it just filled in. So too, it would occupy a number of human lives tied to the earth. Okay, that's the whole notion of the Pythagorean transmigration, where there is no evolution of the soul, so to say, or of that. In this case, he's not even talking about soul. He's talking about a vital personality, a vital formation. So that would be an option of something which is created by universal life to have experiences without any sense of evolution taking place in it. And finally, he's talking about something created by universal life which evolves but is not necessarily tied to the earthly life. That is, it evolves to a point where it has a distinct personality, a kind of individualized inner form, but its evolution can continue in worlds outside material world.
So shall we read the next one?
Okay.
Vincent, do you want to read?
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
In Buddhistic thought?
Two paragraphs earlier.
Is that correct?
No, no,
two
no
paragraphs
but even
earlier.
Then, the developing
okay.
Vitalistic theory.
But even then, the developing vitalistic theory need not spiritualize itself, need not admit the real existence of a soul or its immortality or eternity. It might regard the personality still as a phenomenal creation of the universal life by the interaction of life consciousness in physical form and force, but with a wider, more variable, and subtler action of both upon each other, and another history than it had at first seemed to be possible. It might even arrive at a sort of vitalistic Buddhism, admitting karma, but admitting it only as the action of a universal life force. It would admit as one of its results the continuity of the stream of personality and rebirth by mental association, but might deny any real self for the individual or any eternal being other than this ever active vital becoming. On the other hand, it might, obeying a turn of thought which is now beginning to gain a little in strength, admit a universal self, a cosmic spirit, as the primal reality, and life as its power or agent, and so arrive at a form of spiritualized vital monism, In this theory, too, a law of rebirth would be possible but not inevitable. It might be a phenomenal fact, an actual law of life, but it would not be a logical result of the theory of being in its inevitable consequence.
Sorry about that, my mic was muted. This is where he's beginning to connect some of these ideas with the ancient Indian philosophies. And that's where he brings in the notion of a vitalistic Buddhism, where there is no acceptance of the reality of any individual core, but the illusion of an individuality occupies the body due to a process of vitalistic becoming. And so as he's saying over here, of course, in Buddhism, it's not just vitalistic, it's a kind of a mental vital complex of samskaras that occupy bodies. But nevertheless, it's a process of becoming that is driven by its own momentum. So here he's saying that that the universal life, which forms certain personalities, may do so as a kind of, as he calls it later, as a kind of a phenomenal fact, an actual law of life. It just so happens, in other words, asked to explain why it is or why should it so happen, you give an answer that there is no kind of reason for this question to be answered, it so happens. Right? Universal life produces without any kind of being to it or any kind of reality to the individual formations that it inhabits, automatic processes of a vital kind, similar to the automatic processes of a material kind that matter produces. And these processes give the impression of a conscious being while a body is sort of assumed. And then he goes on to say that, in that kind of a theory, it's a total illusion. It's completely unreal. It's just a sort of chance, a fortuitous chance that the interaction of life consciousness with physical form and force give the sense of an individuality to us. But then,
excuse
this, yeah, yes, Vince. Hello,
Debashish, I can't. Excuse me, you're breaking up for me.
Okay, can you hear me now? Hello.
No, you're still, I can hear you right now when you said hello, yeah.
Okay, so that's one possibility, and then of this so-called unspiritual, sort of vitalistic theory, that there is no need to spiritualize itself. There is no existence of a soul or of any spirit backgrounding it. That it is just a kind of play by some laws. Now, another aspect of it he brings in is a spiritualized vital monism. That is, this life force has a spiritual basis to it, but this is that of a cosmic vital purusha of some kind, as he's saying it. Is now beginning to gain a little in strength. On the other hand, it may obey a turn of thought which is now beginning to gain a little in strength, admit a universal self or cosmic spirit as the primary reality or primal reality and life as its power or agent, and so arrive at a form of spiritualized vital monism. In other words, there is not merely a becoming, becoming, but a being that is becoming. But this being is a vital Purusha, a cosmic vital Purusha. That spirit is cause and fount of the formations of life. In this theory too, a law of rebirth would be possible but not inevitable. As he's saying over here, there is no real need either for individualized personalities to persist or for such personalities to continue taking bodies on earth. They could disappear into other worlds, or at any point dissolve into universal vital consciousness.
Let's move on.
Part of the reason why Buddhism, for example, ends up, giving us a vision, a darshan of life as an imprisonment is this. Because it cannot give any coherent explanation to the cosmic phenomenon of rebirth. It just so happens, is the way that they'll put it, that the universal law of life will trap you into a personality that occupies body after body through some kind of invisible mechanism that forces you to experience, a law of causation, a law of karma.
Hello?
Yes.
I lost you for a long time. I don't know whether that is only me. Couple of sentences before.
It happened to me as well.
Oh, I see. Maybe there is the connection is not good, probably.
No, mine hasn't been. Yeah.
I was talking about that particular paragraph and pointing to the fact that in Buddhism, for example, this is one of the reasons why the predominant sense is that of being imprisoned. Because in a sense, they're saying that there's nothing we can do about it. There is no law to it. There is no cosmic rationality to it. There is no idea, in other words, to it. It just so happens that the cosmic becoming empowers a certain kind of a causational force that makes us experience an illusory individuality and the sort of pain of or suffering of being subject to such an illusory individuality.
So, Devashishda, I have a. So in this paragraph and the previous one, he's introduced so many branches. I mean, this possibility, that possibility, and under that possibility, what the ramifications of those are. So, is that something that, I mean, when you try to kind of work that out in your head, it's kind of not so easy to just you have to be really used to that kind of that not just the vocabulary, that kind of thought process, to be able to just quickly run that in your head, correct?
Yeah, this is true, and that's why at certain times he opens up this very, very complex tree, but as you read on, you find that, the focus, I mean, he's done it in a kind of a designed manner, because the focus becomes sharper as you move on. You find that, oh, this is why he's done that. This answers that. By the time you come to an end, the kind of idea behind it all illuminates all those branches, so to say.
Sure, okay, because as we read along, you always, I mean, in a way, you have that uneasy feeling, in a way, that you're not really in control of what you're reading, but you're just kind of going along with it.
sometimes you have to suspend your judgment to get to a point where things start becoming clearer.
Sure.
Also, mind you, that he has a project in mind. So he's actually trying to get us somewhere. And that is actually not really an explanation of all these theories, but there is a central thread that joins his, or a subtext that joins all these, possibilities that he's pulling out. And that subtext is, you bring it out again and again, the inevitability of the theory of rebirth. Like he ends this paragraph also, it says, it might be a phenomenal fact, an actual law of life, but it would not be a logical result of the theory of being and its inevitable consequence. The reason he's doing this again and again is he wants us to see in our mind's eye, at least whether clearly or hazily, this salient fact that none of these really gives us a rigorous, necessary theory of being which needs rebirth.
Hello. Can it be said that before this paragraph, all the other paragraphs were regarding that the soul was like an, necessary... necessary part of the idea, whereas now he is coming to the fact that even there are theories where the soul is not even considered, right?
Two paragraphs before this, like from where we started today and the paragraph before that, he begins with the notion that the soul is not even necessary. He actually begins with the notion as rebirth is not necessary at all to to certain theories of existence. Then, you know, the materialistic theory doesn't need any persistence of any consciousness beyond this body. Then he goes on to consider the theories that talk about the persistence of personality beyond this body, but he's telling us that that persistence is not really necessary. They talk about it, but their theories don't depend on it. This is the point he's making. And the idea of the soul he'll bring up because, in a way, it is necessary for a logical cosmic theory of being for a certain kind of description of rebirth and a certain kind of a core to the psychic life. And that's why he is showing us that those descriptions that don't have those ingredients are not really inevitable. For them, rebirth is not inevitable. Something is lacking there, or they're just phenomenal descriptions, not theories of being.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your guiding us through all this. It's a very difficult thought.
Debashista, he is using this argument that something which is inevitable is right or maybe leads to the truth. But one could question that inevitability itself is a mental phenomena, and as long as we are still in the domain of the mind, we could still go wrong.
Yes, this is true. In fact, Advaita has argued along those lines. In many cases, for example, the central sort of tenet of Sri Aurobindo about teleology, like why do things happen over here? Is there a need for the becoming? Is contested by modern Advaitic thinkers who say that asking that question is not necessary. So ultimately, in the domain of mind, none of this is really absolutely necessary. But the argument of inevitability and of a necessary theory of being is being presented by Sri Aurobindo from the viewpoint of a metaphysics that is rigorous as a possibility. And yet, you see, the reason why he's doing it is that what he will present as a result of that questioning will answer all our deepest intuitions of being. Ultimately, that's the whole magic of darshan. The Vedantic tradition of darshan works on two levels. That's why he's pointed that out pretty early in this book, that it satisfies the mind and it satisfies the intuition. It ultimately satisfies the spiritual vision. So both are going on simultaneously. There are parts where it seems to be more entrenched in satisfying the reason, but at the same time, it's expanding our sense of intuitive correctness.
Actually, which paragraph did he mention before this where the reality itself was not regarded?
I have a very old edition, but the paragraph before the one that we started with today was about two pages back. It says, as a matter of fact, however, we find a great difference, for the old theories affirm, the modern denies rebirth as a part of the universal process. That whole paragraph is denying, is pointing to the denial of the reality of rebirth as describing the modern materialistic idea. And then he goes on
not the reality of rebirth, but the reality itself. Like this Buddhism, this paragraph is questioning the reality itself, reality of being, in other words, reality of existence, whichever you call.
He's not, in this particular paragraph, he has not questioned the reality of existence, but the reality of a soul or its immortality or eternity. he is assuming, that's why it's not really Buddhism, but what he's calling a vitalistic Buddhism. In other words, there is the reality of the vital principle and the material principle, but no reality of individual core existence.
I mean, yeah, I mean, actually, that's what I'm talking about. The reality of core existence, which paragraph denies that? I mean, which, I'm just trying to, connect.
In this paragraph, so where he begins, you see, from the previous one, the previous paragraph, that long and complex paragraph, if you see, he starts with an evolving universal life may have developed on Earth the growing personality that has now become ourselves. So he's not assuming that this, whatever we call ourselves, has any reality as an individual. It has a reality as a universal life force that is shaping certain kinds of molds which it can either break or which can give certain persistence to. And so that persistence that it gives to it doesn't have any individual core reality.
I mean, what core of what did you say before? Did you not say core of existence?
No, I said core of individual existence.
I see. No, I mean the core of existence itself, like the core of any self for that matter.
Here he is not questioning that. Here he is questioning the existence of a core soul, Atman, or whatever you want to call it, that the individual has. But universal principles, he is not questioning the reality of. He is saying that either we have a materialistic standpoint in which we assume the existence of a universal matter and everything else is false, or we have a universal vitalism in which we assume the existence of universal life and everything else is dependent on that, and this is part of that argument right now.
I think in the beginning of book 2, he has devoted full chapters on Maya. But I guess that was not your question, right? Keka, you have a feeling that in this chapter itself, he discussed this sort of Advaita?
Actually, he did discuss that a little bit, but that was a good time back. That was where he was talking about Sushupti, etc. And one of those three theories he was
I'm sorry. My mic was muted. Actually, I started speaking again without turning the mic on. So I'm saying it is not so much from the words of this paragraph, but when you were explaining this last paragraph that we just read, when you were explaining, I think I heard that you were saying that it's by chance we are in this kind of illusion that we exist, or we means, in every way, not only in individual way, but in every way. So from that point, I was, raising the question.
Yeah, I see. No, what I was trying to get at is that the unfortunate illusion that we exist is, what I was talking about was relative to the sense of the we, that is, I am somebody. That, the consciousness that is individualized in this body and having the experience of this world is a reality in itself. That is an illusion to this view, because that is just a construct of a universal life, a wave of universal life that has assumed a certain kind of formation, and that formation will ultimately, totally... will run due to the power of karma for some time, but will totally get dissolved at some point.
So you meant that the illusion is about our individuality, but not our,
not cosmic reality.
Not our manifestation or existence.
The Vashishta, the chapter where Sri Aurobindo discusses on the methods of Vedantic knowledge, that is about this method of intuition and then grounding it with mind and then again moving on with intuition. Is that how we can describe it in short?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Like the method of integration.
Right. He's talking about their three major principles by which we conduct our inquiries. The primary one is going to be experience and intuition. A secondary one is going to be reason. And a tertiary one is going to be the accumulated sort of stock of understandings that tradition provides us. So these are the three bases on which we will proceed. But if the intuition and the experience are being defied by the other two, then we have to answer to it. We cannot assume that what reason is saying or what the stock of what other people in the past are saying are correct. So that's really what's going on over here. That's why he keeps bringing in what Pythagoras has said, or what Judaism has said, or what Advaita and Buddhism has said. On the one hand, he reasons on it on the second, and he's constantly probing the intuitions of our experience on the third. But that's the primary one on which he holds his theories.
Devashish, one more time. That here it says, now I'm actually reading the text, but admitting it only as the action of a universal life force, it would admit as one of its results the continuity of this stream of personality enabled by mental association, but might deny any real self for the individual, which is just you said, or any eternal being other than this ever-active, vital becoming. So this, or any eternal being, this also you think he referred to that individual?
No. Here he's cosmic Purusha. That he's saying that individual individual existence like a soul doesn't need to be there. It's just a kind of a becoming, a vital becoming, or there doesn't even need to be a being to this becoming. That is, that there is no cosmic Purusha, but just vital processes that are going on. So there is a reality to Prakriti, but no reality to any being who is, the master of Prakriti, or who is the presence of Prakriti. It's just
I said reality, what I meant is that the acceptance of this eternal being.
Right. So here you're right. That's why he calls it a vitalistic Buddhism. Because neither is there an individual being, nor is there an eternal cosmic being. But in later in that chapter, he's taking the other stand that there is a being, a kind of a vital Purusha. He says that cosmic spirit is the primal reality and life as its power or agent. So in either case, whether there is a vital being or there isn't a vital being and only a becoming, there is no individual soul in this particular scenario.
Shall we read another paragraph?
Okay.
Rosemary, would you like to read?
Okay. Advaita of the Mayavada, like Buddhism, started with the already accepted belief. Part of the received stock of an antique knowledge of supraphysical planes and worlds and the commerce between them and ours which determined the passage from earth and though this seems to have been a less primitive discovery, a return to earth of the human personality. At any rate, their thought had behind it an ancient perception and even experience, or at least an age-long tradition of a before and after for the personality which was not confined to the experience of the physical universe. For they base themselves on a view of self and world which already regarded a supraphysical consciousness as the primary phenomenon and physical being as only a secondary and dependent phenomenon. It was around these data that they had to determine the nature of the eternal reality and the origin of the phenomenal becoming. Therefore, they admitted the passage of the personality from this to other worlds and its return into form of life upon earth. But the rebirth thus admitted was not in the Buddhistic view a real rebirth of a real spiritual person into the forms of material existence. In the later Advaita view, the spiritual reality was there, but its apparent individuality and therefore its birth and rebirth were part of a cosmic illusion, a deceptive but effective construction of universal Maya.
So here, you see, he's transitioning from the previous paragraphs where he has considered the possibility that if there is a persistence of personality, it is here on earth that it was constructed by processes of a universal life force interacting with a material reality. From such a view, where he has also sort of considered a kind of Buddhism, he is transitioning to the theories that are held by Advaita and by Buddhism of the more spiritual kind. And for these, he's drawing on the kind of stock of beliefs that both Buddhism and Advaita assumed in their beginnings. And these beliefs really come from something Vedantic and perhaps even more prior or primordial than Vedantic, part of the received lore of spiritual realization that forms the Indic discourse. And so over here, you know, whatever Advaita of the Mayavada or Buddhism develop, it has to be something that in some sense refers to some kind of origin that is non-material, that neither a life force nor a worldly existence material worldly existence is the origin of reality. Reality itself has other, extraterrestrial or extra material basis, what he calls supraphysical basis. So that introduces a new kind of twist. Though in essence, the theory of individual core does not again need to be present even in this viewpoint. We could say that the whole mental, vital, physical complex of the cosmos, not of the individual, is sort of derived from something beyond it. That is part of the lore, as he's talking about over here. And that is becomes the staging ground for experience. And what experiences is either something, again, illusory, which seems to enter into this through its own processes, or something which is based on some substratum which is beyond it. But nevertheless, again, neither of these two views, which rest on the supraphysical, are inevitable in terms of the existence of the soul as a reality or its persistent rebirth as a reality. What changes, however, is the notion of a reality outside of this existence, which is confined by material and vital forces of becoming. So whatever the personality is, it has existences outside of the material world in supraphysical realms in the Advaitic and Buddhistic views of reality.
Shall we read another paragraph?
Okay, we can read one more and sort of leave it there.
Okay. In Buddhistic thought, the existence of the self was denied, and rebirth could only mean a continuity of the ideas, sensations, and actions which constituted a fictitious individual moving between different worlds, let us say, between differently organized planes of idea and sensation. For in fact, it is only the conscious continuity of the flux that creates a phenomenon of self and a phenomenon of personality. In the Advaitic Mayavada, there was the admission of a Jivatman, an individual self, and even of a real self of the individual. But this concession to our normal language and ideas ends by being only apparent. The footnote on the real self of the individual is The self in this view is one. It cannot be many or multiply itself. There cannot therefore be any true individual, only at most a one self omnipresent and animating each mind and body with the idea of an I. For it turns out that there is no real and eternal individual, no I or you, and therefore there can be no real self of the individual, even no true universal self, but only a self apart from the universe, ever unborn, ever unmodified, ever unaffected by the mutations of phenomena. Birth, life, death, the whole mass of individual and cosmic experience become in the last resort no more than an illusion or a temporary phenomenon. Even bondage and release can be only such an illusion, a part of temporal phenomena. They amount only to the conscious continuity of the illusory experiences of the ego, itself a creation of the great illusion, and the cessation of the continuity and the consciousness into the superconsciousness of that which alone was, is, and ever will be, or rather which has nothing to do with time, is forever unborn, timeless, and ineffable.
Okay, so maybe we can resume that paragraph next time. I just wanted to point out that towards the end of that paragraph, that sentence, is a little complex there, where he says that even bondage and release can be only such an illusion, a part of temporal phenomena. They amount only to... And then the first clause over there is related to bondage, and the second clause to release. They amount only to the conscious continuity of the illusory experiences of the ego, itself a creation of the great illusion. That part relates to bondage, and the cessation of the continuity and the consciousness into the superconsciousness of that which alone was, is, and ever will be, or rather, which has nothing to do with time, is forever unborn, timeless, and ineffable, which is relating to that one word, release.